Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Live Through Jesus podcast with Courtney Gilmore. On this episode, Divine Providence. This is 2 Samuel 16, 17, and 18. It's really hard for us to understand how God works in our lives, right? Whenever a specific thing happens, often we want to try to figure out, where is God in this? You know, what is he doing? Why is he doing it this way? Why isn't he doing anything? And we are not ever going to understand all of the ways of God. He tells us that in his word. We can't comprehend how he works or why he does what he does. But there are a couple of things that we do know that we can stand on whenever we are questioning what in the world is going on. And so that's what we're going to talk about today at the end of this lesson, is what do we know about how God works, so that at least we don't have misperceptions of him. We are not ever going to completely understand God, but we don't want to misunderstand him, right? And so all through David's life, we see God working. And today we're going to see that he actually withdraws his hand of protection from David in certain ways, and then protects him and completely orchestrates certain things to keep him protected and to make things happen the way that he wants them to happen in other circumstances. And so let's go ahead and go through this story. We'll see how God is working in David's life, and then we'll talk about what the Bible says about how God intervenes in our lives and why sometimes maybe he doesn't intervene. So if you will remember, we've been going through this long story that started with David and his sons, and one of the sons raped one of the half-sisters, and then his other son killed him for that. He was in exile for several years. David finally brought him back, and they seemingly have reconciled, and then all of a sudden, Absalom turns on him. And he has run David out of Jerusalem. And so that's where we pick up our story today. David is in exile, and Absalom is just now coming into the city of Jerusalem to, you know, sit there as king. That is where we are starting today. And remember that he has his counselor that he has brought with him that used to be David's counselor, Ahithophel. This is Bathsheba's grandpa, and he has decided to leave David and take Absalom's side. And so both of them come in, along with all of the men that have gathered around him from all of the other tribes. And they arrive at the gate of Jerusalem at the exact time as Hushai arrives there. And remember, Hushai is David's friend. He actually is on David's side. He went to David, and David said, "You would be more useful to me if you would go back and advise my son, be an opposing counsel to Ahithophel, so that he can't, come and hurt me, so that Ahithophel's counsel turns to foolishness." That's what he asked God. David said, "Please turn Ahithophel's counsel to foolishness and don't let his plans prevail against me." And so he asks Hushai, "Go and be an opposing counsel so that Absalom can't come and kill me, so that the plans don't work." And so he comes into the city at the same thing time as Absalom, and he says, "Long live the king." And Absalom's like, "Wait, you're my dad's friend. Why aren't you with him? You're not a very loyal friend, are you?" And he says, "No, I'm actually not. I'm not a loyal friend because I'm not loyal to your dad. I'm actually loyal to the throne. And so I'm here to serve whoever God and the people select as king. And better for me that it's David's son. And so I'm willing to serve you." And this seems like a good enough answer to Absalom. And so he says, "Okay, you can come into my council too." But he turns to Ahithophel as his first act. He wants to know, "What should I do? What should my first act as king be?" And in verse 23 of chapter 16, it says that the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was taken as though one inquired of the word of God. So was his advice regarded both by David and by Absalom. So basically, whatever he says, they feel like he is saying it like it's the gospel truth. You know, that's how they're saying it here, as if God has given him the words himself. And so he says, what should I do? And Ahithophel doesn't give him the words of God. This is not something that God would say, and we will talk about that at the end of our lesson. But he gives him advice that all of the other people in all the other nations, things that they would do. Back then, if you would conquer a land, then you would often take the women for yourself. The people of the town would take the women for themselves, and you would take the king's women. And this is to show, hey, you know, I've definitely taken your kingdom because I took your women. You know, if I've got your women, I've got your kingdom. And so Ahithophel says, I think that's what you should do, because David left behind 10 of his concubines. And so I think you should sleep with those women. And that will show not only that you've taken David's kingdom, but it'll also show the people that you've definitely broken ties with your dad. Well, normally, you know, for us, first of all, again, this is not what we would do. This isn't a godly act to sleep with, you know, a bunch of women all at once and, you know, all of those things. We wouldn't do that. But if you were to do that, the thought process in our mind is, well, yeah, he's gonna, you know, just go into his dad's house and take his dad's women as his wives. And so, you know, everybody just assumes that he's sleeping with them because they all live there and he's taking them on as his wife. But no, this is all so graphic. What he does is he pitches a tent at the top of his dad's house on the roof, because the roofs were flat. And he ceremoniously, you know, parades these women into his tent in front of all of the Israelites so everybody can see, hey, I'm taking in my dad's women and I'm sleeping with them, you know. And so, again, crazy and, you know, graphic and nothing that we can even comprehend these days. But this is what he does. And we'll talk later about what God would have to say about that. But this is how Ahithophel does when he first gets into the kingdom. And then after he does this, then Ahithophel says, okay, now I think you need to give me 12,000 men and I'll go after your dad, because he's probably weary from his travels and just generally discouraged. This would be the perfect time to attack. And I'm not going to kill any of the rest of the people with him. I'll only kill David because he's the only one that is a threat to you. And once he's gone, then I'm sure that the rest of the people will just follow you, because their king that they want to follow is dead, and so they might as well follow you. And then I'll be able to just bring them back to Jerusalem, and, you know, they'll accept you as king. And this sounds like a good plan to Absalom also. But this time, instead of just taking Ahithophel's advice, he turns to Hushai and he says, what do you think about this plan? And Hushai says, this time I do not think that's a good idea, because your dad is a good warrior. And so are all the rest of the people with him. Remember, Joab has been his commander since he was fighting with Saul. And so he's like, him and Abiathar, both of them are David's nephews, and they've been with him the whole time. Then he's got Atiah and all of the people that have followed him from Gath, so ever since Saul died. And so he's like, all of these are skilled warriors, and your dad's a skilled warrior. And so anybody that you have here is not near as experienced as him. And so 12,000 men isn't going to be enough, for one. Two, they are such skilled warriors that your dad is too smart to sleep with the rest of the troops. And so he's probably already hiding out somewhere in some ravine or pit or something. And he's also not going to leave all of his troops together. He's going to divide them up so that you can't kill everyone at once. And so, you know, you're going to need a lot more men than that. And also, these men are not going to be running scared like Ahithophel said. They're mad because they got driven from their home just like David did. And so they're like a mama who's been robbed of her cubs, you know, and they're going to be fighting mad. And so they're not going to run away. And since David is going to be hiding, you're going to have to approach them and they're not going to run. So they're going to fight. And if you kill one of their people, then they're going to be so aggressive that y'all are going to run away. You know, nobody is going to be able to stand against them with just the 12,000 men. They're going to be angry. And so what I think you need to do is I think you need to gather people from all over Israel. Get as many men as you can from every single tribe. And I think you need to lead the charge because you're taking the kingdom from your dad. You need to actively take it. You know, which is good advice, you know, take responsibility for what you are doing. Don't let someone else do it. And then he said, I also think that you need to kill everyone because, again, you're going to have to fight them. They're not going to run away from you. They're not going to just let you kill your dad and then leave and follow you. They're going to fight you. And if they fight you, you have to fight them back. And once you start fighting, you need to kill them all. Because if you don't and you leave anybody alive, they're gonna keep coming after you until you're all dead. And, you know, if you're able to, you know, make them surrender, they won't surrender for long. They'll turn against you. They're not going to follow you. And so I think that you need to get all these people, as many as you can, lead the charge, and then kill all of, you know, your dad and all of his men. And then come back and rule the people that actually want to be ruled by you. And Absalom and his all of his advisors, everybody that's with him, is like, that is a better plan. He's right. Well, so he goes to gather all of the people from Israel to come with him and fight. And meanwhile, Hushai is using this plan to stall. He's like, it's going to take him a while to get all of these people. And so I can get word to David while he's doing this, and then he'll have time to prepare. And so remember that David had sent back the two priests and said, you know, if you ever need to send me a message through your two sons. And so Hushai runs to the priest and he says, I need you to send a young servant girl to the well that is in the place where your sons are hiding or where they're at right now to give them a message. And let them know that they need to tell David that he needs to cross over the Jordan River because Absalom's men are coming. And if they don't get over on the other side of the river, then they're going to be trapped between Absalom's army and the water. And then they'll just be pushed into the water and die. And so they need to get across and get prepared and have the battle over there. And by sending this girl to tell them, it won't look suspicious. Everybody will just think she's going to get water. And so she can give this message and then they can go and tell David. And so that's what happens. They send the girl, but there is a boy that sees what happened and he catches on. He realizes, you know, she's not just going to get water. She's giving a message to the priest's sons, and they're trying to get a message to David. And so he goes and tells Absalom. So Absalom sends some servants out to kill the priest's sons, or at least capture them and not allow them to get the message out to David. But they hurry and run. They know that, you know, they need to get this message to David quickly. So they're running and they hide in a cistern in the town of, I can't quite remember. Let's see if I can find the name. It's not even going to mean anything to y'all anyway, really, if I read it. But it's the same town that Shammai, the same Benjamite town that Shammai was cursing him and throwing the rocks at him from. And so everybody apparently from Saul's old tribe doesn't hate David because he's in the same town, and a woman hides them there in the cistern. She covers it with grain so that nobody knows they're there. And then when the servants come and ask if she's seen the men, she says, yeah, they already crossed over the brook. And so she sends them on the way. They go to look for these men. They can't find them. They finally return back to Jerusalem. And when the coast is cleared, they leave and they go and tell David, you know, what's going on. And it says, by morning, David has already gone to across the river, and everybody is across the river. And then we find out that during this time, the Ahithophel, when he realizes that Absalom didn't take his advice, he's like, well, we're all going to die now. And so I'm not going to go with them to battle. I'm not going to get killed by David and his men. You know, I am a definite betrayer because he was working in the council of David. And so he says, they'll be after me. I'm not going to allow them the satisfaction of killing me. I'm going to kill myself. And so he goes to his house, gets everything in order, kills himself, and is buried in his dad's tomb. And then Absalom takes as his commander his other cousins. So David has Joab and Abiathar, which are his nephews, cousins to Absalom. And this guy is a cousin to both Absalom and Joab and Abiathar. They're all sisters of David's mom. And so kids of the sisters. So anyways, they're all their cousins. And so he chooses Amasa to be his commander. And then David takes Abiathar, Joab, and Atiah and separates his troops in thirds and makes each one of them commander over those troops. And then he gets all the way to, they all go before he separates them out. They all go north 37 miles to the place that Ishbosheth was ruling whenever he was an opposing king to David. So remember that right after Saul died, Abner, his commander, put Ishbosheth, his only living son, in charge as the new king. But Judah adopted David as king. So David was ruling in Hebron, and Ishbosheth had crossed the river, and he was ruling over all of Israel except for Judah in this city in Gilead on the eastern side of the Jordan. Well, David was ruling in Jerusalem when his son went to Hebron, which is where he ruled over Judah. And he pronounced himself the king of Hebron. But then when David left, he went into Jerusalem, and David went into the basically capital that Ishbosheth ruled from on the eastern side of the Jordan. And so again, there are two kings, each ruling, one in Jerusalem, one in Gilead. And so that's how this is playing out right now. And when David got there, three men came to welcome him. One of the men, he is the brother of Hanun, which is the vassal king that David put in charge of the Ammonites. Whenever they defeated the Ammonites, he let an Ammonite still rule over that land, but he was under David's control. And this is his brother. And this would have been a perfect time for them to, you know, rebel against David, but apparently they like him. And so he comes and brings some animals and some food to him, along with Machir, which was the one who sheltered Mephibosheth whenever, remember, he is the only son that lived of Jonathan's whenever Jonathan and Saul and all of his brothers got killed, Jonathan's brothers got killed in the battle, his son is the only one that survived because he was very young. The nurse was running with him. She dropped him. He became crippled. And so Mocker is the one that took him in. And David found him at Mocker's house and brought him to Jerusalem to take care of him there. And so this guy Mocker also came to take care of David whenever he fled from his son. And then the third man that came was a wealthy man from Gilead. And they all brought David, you know, basically things that he would need, animals and food and all of that. And then David divided his army up amongst those three men that I told you about before, and then sends them out to battle. And he says that he wants to go with them to battle. And they're like, yeah, that's a bad idea. You're the only one they want. And so even if we all ran away, they would still come to kill you. So no point in that. And then if they killed half of us, they wouldn't care. They only want you. You're worth 10,000 of us. And so you need to stay here. And David's like, okay, that's fine. I get it. You're right. I'll stay here. But please be gentle with young Absalom. And so, you know, we don't know if he's calling him young Absalom because it's like, he's my baby, you know, he's my son still, be gentle with him. Or if it's because he's like, you know, he's just a hot-headed young guy. He isn't thinking clearly, you know, he's not old and wise like we are. And so please be gentle with him because he's not thinking clearly. He's not doing the right thing here. Either way, he's like, you know, basically, don't kill my son. You know you have to go out to battle, but be gentle with him. And so they all go out to battle. It says in the forest of Ephraim, but there's a little problem with that because Ephraim doesn't have any land on the eastern side of the Jordan. And this is actually the land that belongs to the half tribe of Manasseh that has stayed there on that eastern side. And but that's not a lie. Because the reason that they called it the land of Ephraim is because both Ephraim and Manasseh were Joseph's children, remember? And all of Jacob's children each received one piece of land. All that's what is called the tribes of Israel, is each one of his 12 children. And Joseph was one of his 12 children. But because Joseph got sold into slavery and he, you know, had a bad life, Jacob said, I will take both of your sons that were born before I came here to Egypt, and I'll give each one of them a piece of land as if they were my sons. And so they got each one of them a piece of land. Instead of Joseph getting one piece of land, he got two, basically. And so since Ephraim, even though Ephraim was the youngest son, Jacob gave him the oldest child's blessing. And since he gave him the oldest child's blessing, all of Joseph's land is sometimes called by the name of Ephraim. It's basically saying Joseph's land by calling it by his oldest son, even though this is Manasseh's land, okay? So they're in the forest there in Gilead is basically what it is. And that's what it was. It was Gilead's land before Manasseh took it over. And so it says that David's men defeated them that day, Absalom's men, and 20,000 men died there in the forest. And it said that the forest killed more people than the sword. So the terrain and the, you know, trees and the density of the forest killed more men than the sword. But Absalom also got killed by the forest because it says that he was riding underneath an oak tree and he got hung by the branches of the oak tree by his long, luscious hair. Remember, this was his glory, that he had this long, luscious hair. And his hair was flying as he's riding his mule, and it gets caught up in the branches, and he's hanging there. And one of David's men sees this, and he runs to Joab and tells Joab that, you know, he saw him hanging from the tree. And Joab's like, well, did you kill him? And he's like, no, I didn't kill him. And he's like, Well, I would have given you 4 ounces of gold and a belt if you would have killed him. And he's like, you couldn't pay me 25 pounds worth of gold to kill David's son. He's like, I heard him telling y'all to be gentle with his son, and there's no way that I'm going to kill his son. The king knows everything. He would have found out, and you would have thrown me under the bus. I know it. And so he's like, that's not worth it to me. Job's like, fine, I don't have time to fight here with you. I'm going to kill him myself. Remember, Job is the one that brought Absalom back and tried to reconcile him and David in the first place. And there was speculation that he had some sort of evil intent towards David when he did that, but that doesn't make any sense because he has joined David now. And so he seemingly was trying to reconcile David with his son for David's sake. And now David's son has betrayed him too. It's like, I brought you back. You know, yeah, I was doing that for your dad, but I got you, you know, back into the family, and now you have betrayed him. And so you betrayed me too. And so it probably gives him some satisfaction to be the one that kills him. He definitely wants him dead. And so he leaves and finds Absalom in the tree, and it says throws 3 javelins at him, kills him, but also his armor bearers surround him, 10 of them, and they also strike Absalom while he's hanging there in the tree, just for good measure, you know, just so they can make sure that he's dead. And then Joab blows the trumpet and calls off all his men and says, you know, we've won the battle, quit fighting, leave the rest of the guys alone. And then they don't dignify Absalom with a proper burial. Instead, they dig a pit and throw his body in the pit and throw a pile of rocks over the top of it. And some say that maybe this had a little bit of symbolism too, because maybe it was as if they were like stoning him, you know, even though that's not how they killed him. When you throw all those stones on top of him, that would be symbolizing stoning him. And that was actually the punishment for a son who was rebellious and unrepentant about it. Like, basically just like, I am never going to do what you say, Dad. You're not my boss. I'm doing what I want. And I'm completely, totally, you know, rebelling against you. And so, you know, obviously he has done that with David, providing he was trying to kill David. And so they were saying, you know, maybe it had a little symbolism that they just cover him with a big pile of rocks. It also drew a stark contrast between a pillar that Absalom set up for himself in the King's Valley, which is just outside of Jerusalem, because he said, I don't have any sons to carry on my name, so I'm going to set this pillar up for myself in my own name, because I don't have anybody else to carry on my name. And so this would have been like this big monument that he set up for himself. And they're like, yeah, you don't get that. You just get a big pile of rocks. And so he got, obviously, what he deserved. If you'd like to receive this as a written lesson, then go to livethroughjesus.substack.com and become a paid subscriber there. With your subscription, you'll receive 4 lessons every month by email and access to all the previous lessons. And digital studies are great because all of these scripture references are linked, and so you can just click on them right from your device. You don't have to flip through your Bible, and you can change it to whatever version you want to read the lesson in. Then digital studies are also good if you'd like to do them with a group, because you only have to get 1 subscription, and then you can just print off all your materials, so everybody doesn't have to get their own book. And so it's only $6 a month or $60 a year, and you'll just be able to do continuous studies with me. So go to livethroughjesus.substack.com if you would like this written study. That is the story, but I want to talk about this. First of all, fact that Absalom slept with all of David's wives, and then how God took care of David throughout this entire ordeal. And so even though it says that everybody regarded Ahithophel's words as, you know, the gospel truth, as God's word, it was not. This advice that he gave to Absalom to sleep with all of these women was not godly advice. This is not something that God would have condoned, because God said in the same chapter that he said that you're not supposed to sleep with your half-sister, and that's what, you know, started all of this mess with Amnon. He also said that a man is not supposed to sleep with the same woman as his dad. And so Absalom was doing that. And so God would have never told him to do that. But this was a fitting a punishment for David. Remember, God told David through Nathan that his son would raise up the sword from his own family, and that other people would sleep with his wives because he had slept with Uriah's wife. And so I'm going to read you that. This was David's punishment given to him for sleeping with Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. This is 2 Samuel 12, beginning in verse 9, and it says, "Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and you've taken his wife to be your wife, and you've killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you've despised me, and you've taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. And so, I, the Lord, will raise up adversity against you from your own house." So that's what's happened with Absalom. "And I'll take your wives before your eyes, and I'll give them to your neighbor, and he will lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all of Israel, before the sun." And so, that raises a couple of questions for us, right? Because was that just a prophecy by God saying that that's what's going to happen to David? Or did he cause this to happen as his punishment? This does seem to be David's punishment, right? From God. He says, I'm going to cause these things to happen. But how does God cause these things to happen? That would be the question. And so if God didn't give these words to Ahithophel because that would be a sin, then how is it that he used this to be a punishment to David, right? What happened is that this was a prophecy to David on what would happen when God withdrew his hand of protection from him, when God chose not to intervene. Because these things, the son wanting to kill the dad when there's a dynasty so that he can get the kingdom, we all have heard, you know, stories from back whenever there were dynasties that the dad would worry that the son would try to kill him so he could take the throne early. You know, it's like, dad's past his time, I want to get the throne. And so he would be paranoid about that, or that it would actually happen. So that's a natural thing that happened. Also, a natural thing is for whoever takes the throne to sleep with the women to prove that they have actually taken the throne. And so what God did is he withdrew his hand of protection and decided not to intervene when Absalom did the exact thing that, you know, normally happens, where a son would rise up against his father thinking he would be a better king than his father and rushing the, you know, the rise to the throne. And also the sleeping with the concubines. Now, did God orchestrate that he slept with them on the roof, the exact same roof most likely that David was first tempted with Bathsheba on? Right? That makes sense. That makes sense that God would have orchestrated that. But, and he said, you know, I'm going to make sure that everybody knows it, that it's not a secret, so that it's on that same roof and that it's not a secret. Yeah, that's orchestrated by God. But God wasn't going to tell Absalom to lie, to sin. God doesn't, the Bible tells us that God isn't tempted by sin, and he doesn't tempt us to sin. I'm gonna read you James. We've talked about it before, but I'm gonna read you James 1, because this is when God tells the people that he does not cause people to sin. This is James 1, beginning in verse 13. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's full grown, gives birth to death. And so that clearly says God does not tempt anyone to sin. He cannot do evil, and he won't tempt you to do evil. And so he did not orchestrate that. God did not tell Absalom, you need to sin so I can punish your dad in the same way that he took Uriah's wife. I want you to take his wives. He didn't do that. But he did withdraw his hand of protection from David as a punishment, knowing that these are the things that a son would be tempted to do, to take the throne from the father, and he was going to allow that to happen, allow him to rise up against his father, and then he also was going to allow him to take his wives. Maybe he did, like I say, allow him to do it on the roof and where everybody could see it, because that's just such a weird thing, but that is all. But God didn't withdraw his hand of protection from David completely, right? Only selectively, only so that he could suffer specific punishments that were, fitting for the crime that David had committed. But the rest of the time, God was still with David and he was still protecting David, right? Because he gave him Hushai to give him the right counsel. He made Ahithophel's counsel foolishness, just as David asked him to. He allowed him time to get word to the two priests, and then protected the two sons while they got word to David. He let him get over into the other side of the Jordan River safely. He let him make it all the way up to the capital. He let David still have his core skilled warriors with him. Joab and Abiathar both stuck with him the whole time. All the Gittites and leader of the Gittites, all of those people stuck with David. They're all skilled fighters. He also allowed those people, the three important men, to come to him, which were important men to come and serve him because, the brother of the Ammonite king, like I said, it would have been a perfect time for them to revolt. Yet God gave him favor towards David instead. He also gave the wealthy Gilead, the guy that lived in Gilead, he gave him favor on him, which would be important because he's now standing in the land of Gilead. So for him to give him favor towards him, that was all important. He also got David out of the kingdom, the town of Jerusalem, so that none of the infrastructure in Jerusalem got destroyed in the battle, and instead made it be in the forest, so that nobody, no infrastructure was destroyed, and that the forest was killing most of the people. And then he also turned Absalom's plan around on himself, made Absalom die, and also in a fitting way, right? In the way that, his hair was his glory, and then that actually was the way that he died. And so God was protecting David all the while, orchestrating all of those things. So in some ways, he was withdrawing his protection from David to make his plan work out. And in some ways, he was intervening on David's behalf to make his plan work out. And so we don't understand exactly how God does that, how God works on our behalf, or why he does it in the certain ways that he does it. But we know that he does, because in Romans 8:28, it says that we know that God causes all things to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And so that we can know, right? Like I said at the very beginning of this, there's a lot of things we don't know about God, a lot of how he works that we can't understand, but we can know that. We can know that he does work on our behalf, and that he always works for our good and for his glory. We know that to be true. And so sometimes that good is blessings and mercy. And then sometimes that good is, you know, consequences, serving consequences of our actions. That's good for us to get a just punishment, right? Sometimes that is good for us. Sometimes he is getting justice for someone else, and that is good for his kingdom and for his people who he's getting justice for. And so, you know, it may not always look good to us, but it always is for our good and for the good of his people. And so Psalm 87, actually 57, because I can't see well. Psalm 57, 2 says, I will cry to God Most High, to God who accomplishes all things for me. So God accomplishes everything that he accomplishes for us is done by God. Scratch that. And then in Psalm 84, 11 to 12, it says, for the Lord God is sun and shield. The Lord gives grace and he gives glory. He withholds no good thing from those who walk with integrity. Lord of armies, blessed is the person who trusts in you. So God doesn't withhold good things from us, right? But again, we just don't always see things in the same way as God sees them. And so sometimes it may not feel good to us, but God knows that it is good for us. He knows what he's doing, and nothing that God ever does is bad or wrong. He can't do bad or wrong things. Deuteronomy 32:4 says that he is the rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are just. He is a God of faithfulness without injustice. Righteous and just is he. So God is perfect. He is righteous. He is fair. Everything he does is good and right and fair. That's what this says. And so, you know, even though we can't understand how God works, we know he does work for us. We know that everything that he does is good. Everything that he does is right. Everything that he does is fair. The Bible tells us that. So again, we may not understand exactly how God works, but we know that he doesn't do anything bad or wrong. That everything he does is good, right, true, and just. And then Job 34, 10 to 12 says, far be it from God to do evil, and from the Almighty to do wrong. He repays a person for his work, and he lets things happen in correspondence to a man's behavior. God certainly will not act wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. So he lets things happen according to our behavior sometimes, but he never does anything wrong or wicked or bad. He also never causes us to do wrong. He may allow us to do wrong. He may let us do something wrong and then allow us to serve the consequences of that. It says he lets things correspond to our behavior. Maybe he allows us to do that, and then he lets us suffer the consequences of that, and then uses them for his glory and our good. Maybe that is the case. But he never causes us to do wrong. And that's what he did with Absalom. He didn't cause Absalom to do the wrong things, but he let him do the wrong things without intervening. And so Joseph says this to his brothers all the way back in Genesis 50, verse 20. Whenever Joseph's brothers are worried now that his dad has died, that Joseph is going to take revenge on them for selling him to the Egyptians. And he says, no, you meant that for evil, but God meant it for good, to bring about the present result, to keep many people alive. And so he says, you know, God didn't make his brothers sin and sell him, but God used their sin to save not only, you know, Joseph, not only Joseph's family, but all of the Jews. And the surrounding area. And so he says, he took your sin, even though you meant it for evil, God took it and he used it for good. And then in Psalm 81, 11 to 12, it says, but my people did not listen to my voice and Israel did not obey me. And so I gave them over to the stubbornness of their heart to work by their own plans, to walk by their own plans. So he's saying, sometimes I give you over to your sin. Sometimes I just don't protect you from that. And I let you do what you do, and then you serve the consequences of your actions. On the other hand, sometimes God does save us from our sins. Sometimes he does intervene and keep us from sinning. He protects us from ourselves sometimes and from the ways of this world. And prevents us from following through with our sinful plans. And so in Psalm 19:13, we see this in several verses, all when people are praying that God would protect them from their own sins, their own sinful nature. And so presumably if we can ask for God to protect us from that sin, then he does do that sometime. And so in Psalm 19:13, it says, keep your servant back from presumptuous sins. Let them not rule over me. And then I will be innocent and I will be blameless of great wrongdoing. So keep me from premeditated sin so that I will be innocent and I won't do things wrong against you. So if we can ask that God would keep us from premeditated sin, then the assumption is that he does that sometimes. Matthew 6:13, Jesus tells the people how to pray, and part of that prayer, he says, to ask God not to lead us into temptation, but to deliver us from the evil one. So, you know, God can deliver us from those temptations, keep us from sinning. And then in Psalm 141, 3 and 4, this might be the most comprehensive. It says, set a guard, Lord, over my mouth and keep watch over the door of my lips. Do not incline my heart to any evil thing, to practice deeds of wickedness with people who do wrong. And may I not taste their delicacies. So place a guard over my mouth means shut it, you know, don't allow me to say anything that would be sinful. And then don't incline my heart to evil things. So change my heart. Keep me from even wanting to sin. Keep me from that temptation. And then don't let me practice the wickedness that other people practice. Don't even let me, dabble in the things that other people are doing and want to do them. So keep my mouth, keep my heart, keep my hands, and keep my feet all from sin. And so only God knows why sometimes he chooses to allow us to sin and suffer the consequences of that. Sometimes why he allows us to sin and then grant us mercy from the consequences of that. And why sometimes he just doesn't allow us to sin at all. Sometimes he just intervenes and he's like, nope, I'm shutting your mouth. Nope, I'm blocking that path. I am not going to allow you to do this. We don't know why God chooses to do that sometimes in a certain way and why he does it in a different way. Often God is working behind the scenes and we don't even know he's doing anything. So it's not just that he's, you know, purposefully not intervening or that he is intervening and we watch it. We have no idea that it's even happening. Sometimes that is the way. And the only way we even know that he did it, you know, sometimes is upon reflection years later. And we're like, oh, God was taking care of me this whole time and I had no idea. Or he was going before me and he was working all things together for me and I didn't even see it, you know. And so God works on our behalf all the time. And sometimes we know it and sometimes we don't. And when we do know it, sometimes we don't understand it. And God is the only one that can understand those things. And so I'm going to read you several verses that just tell us how God does that. God is working behind the scenes or right in front of our faces sometimes, even though we don't quite understand what he's doing. And so Job 23:13-14 says, God is unique. And who can make him turn? Whatever his soul desires, that is what he does. For he carries out what is destined for me, and many such destinies are with him. And then in Psalm 33, 6 to 15, it says, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their lights. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap, and he puts the depths in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the earth stand in awe of him. It just shows how he's in charge of the whole universe, right? And then in verse 9, it says, he spoke and it was done. He commanded and it stood firm. And then the Lord nullifies the plans of nations. He frustrates the plans of people. The plans of the Lord are what will stand forever. The plans of his heart from generation to generation. So he nullifies the plans of nations, of a whole entire nation. He's just like, nope, you're not doing that. And he frustrates their plans. He allows them not to happen. You know, he makes their plans chaos. And then he says, my plan's what's going to happen. I am going to make sure that what I want to happen happens and what you want to happen doesn't happen. And so it says, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people that God has chosen for his own inheritance. The Lord looks from heaven and he sees all of mankind. And from his dwelling place, he looks on all of the inhabitants of the earth, and he fashions the hearts of them all. He who understands all of their works. How God does that? I've got no idea, right? Again, we know that God is doing these things and we can't quite understand how he frustrates our plans and how he nullifies the plans of nations and how he says, no, my word is going to be done. But we know that he does it. And when he does it, we know that it's good and right and true. Psalm 139, 5 and 6 says, you have encircled me behind and in front, and you've placed your hand on me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too high, I can't comprehend it. So he's like, you hedge me in behind and before, and you protect me all the ways around. And how you do that, I've got no idea. That's too high for me to understand. And then in verse 16, he says, your eyes have seen my formless substance, and in your book were written all the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there were none of them. So he's saying, you've ordained all my days before they even happened. How that happens, I don't know, right? But God is in charge. And so sometimes he allows us to do what we want to do. Sometimes he intervenes. And all of that is under his control. Just as a parent, you know, sometimes allows their kids to do things and lets them serve the consequences of it. And sometimes they see what they're doing and they intervene and make them stop. And, you know, that's what God does. God sees all of what we're doing, and sometimes he intervenes and sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes he prepares the way before us and, you know, helps us to walk in a smooth path. And sometimes he, you know, doesn't do that. Sometimes he allows us to just walk the normal path of earth. And so, again, we don't know why he does all of that the way that he does it, and we don't know how he does it, but we know that he does. Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. So God, nothing's by chance. You know, the lot is cast, but God makes the decision. Proverbs 21:1, the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he pleases. He turns people's hearts, directs their hearts, directs their feelings and their ways. Isaiah 14:24, the Lord of armies has sworn, saying, certainly, just as I have intended, so it has happened. And just as I have planned, it will stand. God's ways are the ways that will prevail. Isaiah 25:1, Lord, you are my God. I will exalt you. I will give thanks to your name. For you have worked wonders, plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness. And then the last one, Isaiah 55:8-11 says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it produce and sprout and provide seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so will my words be which go out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, without accomplishing what I desire and without succeeding in the purpose that I sent them for. So whatever God speaks, it will be accomplished. He will make sure that his purposes are accomplished whenever he makes a decision. And so ask God to intervene on your behalf, to provide for you and protect you and the people that you love. And then trust that he is working in the best way for you. And even if you don't understand it, and know that he's working even when you don't see it. And thank him for that. Thank him for the work that he's doing on your behalf, even when you don't know what it is. And trust him that he is a loving father, watching over his child, taking care of you, and you know, making this life work in the best way possible for you, even if it doesn't feel like it, even if you don't understand it, even if you don't see it. Okay. Like I said, we can't understand everything that God is doing. We don't know how he's working for us, what that actually practically looks like. But we can know that he is working for his children, that he loves us, that he's taking care of us, and that everything that he does is good and right and fair, and nothing is wrong that God does. Absolutely nothing. And so I just think that the most important thing is that, you know, maybe we don't completely understand God, but we don't want to misunderstand him. We don't want to have misperceptions of God. And so hopefully at least I have cleared that up with God's word today of any misperceptions that we might have of God whenever we're looking at a certain circumstance and saying, God, what are you doing? You know, what's happening here? Why aren't you doing something? Why are you doing this the way that you're doing it? And then that is all we can know. We just have to stand on what we know, and that has to be enough for us. We have to know that God's doing what is good and right for us and for all of his people. And, you know, sometimes, you know, God has an entire earth to take care of people. And so just as sometimes, you know, I can't give both of my kids their way, sometimes, you know, to grant justice to this person over here, you have to get punishment. Sometimes to give what is best for this person over here, you might have to endure a little bit of difficulty. In order to allow you to serve the consequences of your actions, it might hurt someone else. You know, those kinds of things happen, and we can't work the whole puzzle together, but we can rest assured knowing that God can. God can work the whole puzzle together. He can be a perfect parent to every single one of his children. And so we just have to trust that he is doing that, even though it doesn't always make sense to us. And so that is the lesson for today. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. We'll be seeing what happens whenever David retakes the throne now that Absalom is dead. David's going to go back into Jerusalem, so that's what we'll talk about next week. And then if you want the blog post that goes along with this study that doesn't do the entire study but just shows you what you can learn from that, then go to livethroughjesus.substack.com, become a free subscriber there, and you can just get the blog post emailed to you and access to all of the previous blog posts. If you want the lesson, then you become a paid subscriber. But if you just want the blog post, then become a free subscriber. And then also subscribe to my separate YouTube and podcast channel, Live Through Jesus Weekly Devotions, where I teach that blog post. It's obviously much shorter because it's just a quick little lesson there. And then also join me on social media at Live Through Jesus. And I'll be posting clips from this episode and then also Bible verses from this episode. And then I'll just see you back next week. Thanks and have a good day.